Andy.
Stop. Right on.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Spring of 1971 was a time of Vietnam War protests, urban race riots, and the nation staggered by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. 30-year-old Marvin Gaye, already the Prince of Motown, felt an overwhelming need to respond in the only way he knew how, through his music. The result was the 9-track album, just 36 minutes long, entitled What's Going On. It was Gaye's first effort as a producer, and the album would be the first by a black artist to address social upheaval in America. What's Going On famously begins with cheery banter and a soaring pop saxophone hook. It quickly makes way for catharsis in pained and angry lyrics that would provide the soundtrack for a nation. What's Going On lifted Marvin Gaye from gifted pop singer to Motown visionary and poet. 30 years later, it's still considered by many the greatest soul album of all time. 18 years ago this month, a gun fired by his own father tragically ended Marvin Gaye's life. But the sound and lyrics of What's Going On still soothe and challenge all at once. Tonight, the origins and staying power of What's Going On. What about Marvin Gaye's indelible concept album Rings True in April of 2002? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Detroit, Michigan is Ben Edmonds. He's the American editor for Mojo magazine and author of What's Going On, Marvin Gaye and the Last Days of the Motown Sound. Welcome, Ben Edmonds.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, Ben. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Ben, this album was an incredible hit, despite what Berry Gordy thought in 1971, and it's an incredible hit again today, 30 years later. Why?
For the same reason that it will be an incredible hit 30 years from today. It is, in a word, timeless. Though it was tied to the era in which it was made, the spiritual nature of the record transcends any particular time period and will probably speak to people for as long as music exists.
This wasn't the way Marvin Gaye started out singing. What brought him to the place where he was laying down these tracks that were so unorthodox that he must have known would be way outside what Mr. Motown, Berry Gordy, would want to hear?
Well, he did know that, and he knew that from years of experience. Marvin had always had kind of a contentious relationship with Motown and with its boss, Berry Gordy, due in no small part to the fact that Berry Gordy was also his brother-in-law. Marvin had married into the family, had married one of Berry Gordy's sisters, which got him closer to the seat of power at Motown, but also created a personality conflict that would never be completely resolved for the entire course of his life.
Don't have your brother-in-law be your boss if you can help it.
Exactly, exactly. And when Marvin first came to Motown, his aspirations were to be kind of a black Frank Sinatra. I mean, he thought his strength was as a crooner. And even though Berry Gordy let him have his way initially and let him record a couple of albums of traditional material, Berry was about having hits and contemporary hits. So initially, he finally found a vehicle for Marvin in a song called Stubborn Kind of Fellow, a rock and roll song that was not really particularly suited to Marvin's strengths as a vocalist, but it became a huge hit record, his very first hit record, in fact, and the kind of first hit that you had at Motown sort of typecast the kind of artist that you would become. So Marvin was typecast as Motown's rock and roll singer, a role that he felt completely uncomfortable in. So from the very beginning, there was tension in the relationship, and it was a tension that did not substantially abate, even as he had hit record after hit record throughout the 60s.
But his hits were not just Peaches and Cream. He had Heard It Through the Grapevine. This was not kiddie music.
No, I mean, Marvin had a wide range of hits on Motown. He used virtually every major producer that Motown had on staff, and they all had hits with him because, above all else, he was a supremely flexible vocalist who could do any sort of material. But just being kind of a vocal vehicle for other people's songs and ambitions was not enough for Marvin Gaye. He believed that he was an artist who had something of his own to say.
Even in What's Going On, you can still hear the crooner. And to me, this is part of what keeps it so young and alive. It's not a desperate sound. There's a strange, sad joy that goes even through the most bleak lyrics.
Absolutely, and you'll find that, to borrow the phrase from the David Ritz biography of Marvin, Marvin was very much a divided soul, and you can hear kind of all those different counterforces at play in virtually everything he does.
This is What's Happening, Brother, behind us right now. He had a personal tragedy when Tammy Terrell died, I guess. She had been his partner very often in singing. And
yeah, she had been his most successful duet partner, and he was a male vocalist who was as known for his duets with female singers as he was for his own solo records. But Tammy Terrell was a special person to him, both musically and personally. And when she collapsed in his arms in 1967 on stage and would later die of an undiagnosed brain tumor, Marvin felt a big part of his world collapse. And when he was forced to add his voice to phony Marvin and Tammy duets that were recorded after she could no longer sing just to keep the commercial machine going, it really deepened his conflict with Motown.
Ty Moses writes that he was a superstar frightened of fame, a hitmaker who longed to be considered an artist, and a deeply religious man who was ambivalent about his status as a sex symbol by the late 60s, early 70s. As he set about the work that would end up being What's Going On, he was also deeply depressed, was he not?
He was absolutely depressed, and it was the combination of what was happening with Tammy Terrell, what was happening in his own career. Even though he had become Motown's number one male vocalist, he felt that none of these records completely reflected his artistry, so he felt that on one level he was being used as a tool.
We're talking with Ben Edmonds about Marvin Gaye's incredible album, What's Going On. It was a huge hit, despite Berry Gordy's disapproval in 1971, and it's back today in so many ways. You can hear a remix of it right now that's out with all kinds of current artists, Bono, Britney Spears, J-Lo, NSYNC, for a benefit album that's out. And we're talking with Ben Edmonds about what created this. Where did he find the lyrics? Where did he find the gist? Where did he find the poetry in this album, Ben Edmonds?
Well, he actually found it from a number of different sources. The one thing that people are most surprised about when they scratch the surface of Marvin Gaye is when they discover that, above all else, he was a collaborative artist. For example, when the song What's Going On was brought to him, that song was pretty well completed by the time it got to him. It had been originally composed by O.B. Benson of the Four Tops.
Who would have thought it?
With his co-writer, a guy named Al Cleveland. The Four Tops had turned it down because they thought it was a protest song and they didn't do protest material. He then tried to sell it to Joan Baez, who expressed some interest but never really followed through. By the time it got to Marvin Gaye, though, it was the right song for the right artist. And in taking the framework that they had given him, Marvin very definitely put his own stamp on the song.
What about a couple of the most sort of branded elements of it? That party shatter at the beginning that's so inviting, and then that wailing alto sax. Was that did that come with the lyrics, or was that Marvin's innovation?
Well, I mean, for example, you will not find that party chatter on the single version of the song. That was something that was added when they put the album together. That was originally, they were going to have a lot of party chatter going through the album, musical segues, little bits and pieces to tie the album together, because Marvin had been watching what had been happening in the previous few years in rock and roll, when it had gone from a singles medium to an album medium, to a medium in which people would then do concept albums. You know, one entire thought carried across the entire spectrum of an album, and that was the kind of album that he wanted to make. So there were a lot of those little kind of devices. You will find the songs kind of stitched together into suites almost. So it was Motown's real, even though it didn't come out until 1971, it was effectively Motown's first 60s-style album, and it just kind of goes to show you how far behind the times Motown really was.
They caught up in one album in a big way. How about
in
that?
In a big way. That, but that saxophone intro that you that you mentioned, which was played by a gentleman named Eli Fontaine, how that came about was Eli came into the session unpacked his saxophone and was just warming up. The tape happened to be rolling. Marvin heard what he liked, and by the time Eli said, I'm ready to record, Marvin said, we are done.
They already had it from his warm-up.
And it's funny, but in the course of researching this book, I had seven or eight different saxophone players claim to be the person who actually played that intro.
Everybody wants to be the famous one.
But in fact, it was a gentleman by the name of Eli Fontaine.
It made me think that Kenny G's career in some debauched way was made at that moment, that alto sax was just seen, became so famous as an instrument.
What a horrific thought, Tom.
Well, I'm sorry, but you know,
even the most
beautiful things can spin off unexpected consequences. Talk to us about the multi-layering. Marvin Gaye's voice is on here, stacked on top of itself again and again. This was not something that Motown had done much of.
No, and it wasn't really something that anybody had done much of. I mean, if you go back, for example, the only real precedent that I find for it is if you go back to an album by a West Coast group called Love a couple of years previous, an album called Forever Changes, you can hear their vocalist Arthur Lee also kind of having dialogues with himself vocally, multi-tracking his vocals. With Marvin, it was something a little deeper, but once again, as with the saxophone part, it happened almost by accident. A studio technician, after the first day of recording, when Marvin had laid down a couple of lead vocal tracks and couldn't decide which one he wanted to use, he had a studio engineer prepare a tape for him in which one of those vocals was on one side of the stereo mix, the other was on the other side, but the engineer made an error and mixed them both into mono, so you had the kind of two vocals interacting with each other. Marvin heard it, loved it, not only kept it for this record, but it did become the hallmark of his vocal style and perhaps the single most imitated thing about this record.
Once again, history made in a beautiful accident. Behind us, of course, Mercy, Mercy Me, and here was Marvin Gaye, a Motown artist, writing an entire song, an incredibly catchy one, about the ecology. I don't know if we even had Earth Day in those days, Ben. What put him onto this?
To tell you the truth, I can't really answer that. I don't really know what specifically moved him to write about ecology, except that it was something that was then becoming a kind of fashionable topic in hip circles, and this was definitely Marvin's bid to be considered a serious artist by the kind of people who were then taking pop music very, very seriously. And if you'll notice, this is one of the few tracks on the album that it bears a solo Marvin Gaye composition credit. So it, whatever the inspiration for it was, it definitely came to him and to nobody else.
It's all his. We're talking with Ben Edmonds, author of Marvin Gaye and the Last Days of Motown, of the Motown Sound. We're talking about Marvin Gaye's great album, What's Going On. What do you hear when you hear What's Going On? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Marvin Gaye's legendary album, What's Going On. Here's his song, God is Love. This hour about What's Going On, the legendary Marvin Gaye album. What do you hear when you hear What's Going On today? How does it resonate for you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Did you listen then? Are you listening now? What is it speaking to in your mind, on your turntable, in your CD player? Today we're joined by Ben Edmonds. He's the American editor of Mojo Magazine and author of What's Going On, Marvin Gaye and the Last Days of the Motown Sound. Ben Edmonds, there's an awful lot of God and religion in this song. He's laying it right out there. Jesus is his friend, and he wants you to know it. A lot of talk about the Father.
Indeed, and a lot of this relates not only to the Heavenly Father, but more specifically to Marvin's earthly father. When Marvin was growing up in Washington, D.C., his father was a preacher in what is called a Hebrew Pentecostal church, which is essentially an African-American church that takes a lot of its practices from strict Hebrew rituals. And Marvin grew up in a very strict religious family, although it must be said by the same token that his father was a womanizer and a cross-dresser. So there was more than
tell me what's going on
in the Gaye household. But you know, I mean, Marvin's strict religious upbringing was once again one of the many conflicts that dogged him throughout his life. On the one hand, he was deeply and very strictly religious, and on the other hand, he was in a very what his father would have considered an immoral business, this show business. And this, as a result, a large part of the power of the What's Going On album comes from the fact that for this very brief moment in time, Marvin was able to resolve those conflicts and create something that was phenomenally spiritual.
He did that. We've got Holy Holy behind us right here. The album is described sometimes as one long song broken into movements, which we see as the cuts. Did Marvin Gaye sit down and plot this all out on a big chalkboard? Did he have it all in mind before he sat down to record? How did it work?
No, he did not. And considering how of a piece it really does sound, the fact that it came together incredibly piecemeal is in itself kind of interesting. For starters, the single sat on the shelf for months before Berry Gordy would release it. When Marvin first brought the single to him, Berry Gordy hated it from first listen, thought that it was, and I believe this is his quote, "the worst piece of blank I've ever heard." One of his comments was that Marvin's scat singing in the middle sounded too old-fashioned and corny, like a Dizzy Gillespie record. What Berry didn't really understand was that Marvin was taking a lot of musically historic threads, but he was weaving them into something that was completely new and fresh. So fresh, in fact, that it wasn't so much that it was bad, but Berry just couldn't relate to it because it was so new.
Listening back, listening again, listening now to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you hear when you hear What's Going On? We're joined now by Jack Ashford. He was a percussionist who worked with Marvin Gaye on many projects, including this album, What's Going On. Good evening and welcome, Jack Ashford.
Hello, how are you?
We're great. Thanks so much for joining us, Jack.
Hey, Jack. Fine, I'm glad to be here.
Jack, tell us about the recording sessions that this album came out of. Were they like all the others that you participated in those days, or could you tell that something different was going on?
Well, it was different in the sense that Marvin was producing himself. and he was using a few musicians that we weren't accustomed to working with, like Shep Forrest on drums. He's a white fellow that played a lot of the clubs in town. Mm-hmm. Excellent drummer. And he was using Chet instead of the normal drum team, you know. And this made it a little different. And plus, he wanted to play piano himself, which I can see why he did that, because there was a lot of spontaneity in his performance mm-hmm. on the track itself, because he knew the track. It was his creation, and so therefore there's things that he could put in spontaneously that Earl might overlook and just go for the routine type thing, which would have been excellent also, but it wouldn't have been what Marvin was looking for.
Jack Ashford, I read that the entire album was recorded in 10 days, is that right?
I don't know how many days it was. I mean, it's hard to say because, you see, at that time, we did things different at Motown. Like, the original session, which I was on at the time, was not the completed work of the rhythm date, you know, by doing mm-hmm. a whole album. Like, he did the original session like that and then went right into a sweetening maybe 2 or 3 days later, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. So it was a compilation of an accumulative type thing where it was coming together, because that's the way he was thinking about it at that time.
It would all stack up.
Right, because not a cassette, because they didn't have a cassette.
Yeah, but a tape, anyway.
They were using 7.5s then.
Right.
He gave me a 7.5 of the date after the, and I still have it because I was supposed to give it back. I'm sorry, Marvin.
You're a little late.
It's a 7.5 tape. And he wanted me to listen to it because there were some things he wanted me to go back and overdub.
Jack Ashford, could you tell, could you see that Marvin Gaye was a man on a mission doing this album? Did he know he was taking a risk? Was there fire in his eye?
No.
He was just making an album.
That's not the kind of cat he was. You know, I mean, he was happy and running in and out the rooms and light up a joint here and pass it over there. And it was just fun, you know. We were having a ball. It wasn't that type of a thing. It was very relaxed. That's, you know, Marvin was relaxed.
Did you ever hear him say, oh, Berry Gordy's going to hate this, but we're doing it anyway?
Oh, no.
He didn't expect that? You think?
Oh, no. He wouldn't have said that. And even if he thought that, he wouldn't have said that.
Hmm.
You know, it's, you know, Marvin was one of the cats. He became one of the guys. And so, therefore, it was a camaraderie that had existed. It made him one of the musicians because he realized he wasn't one of the musicians. So he had to meld himself into that so that the guys wouldn't look at him like something strange, you know.
Right.
Because remember, we had 2 conga players on that date, which was unusual.
Ben Edmonds, Jack Ashford's telling us it was just another recording session of passing a joint around, having a good time, and out came What's Going On.
Yeah. Well, that's part of it. And as long as we've got Jack on the phone, I should add, just for the historical record, that it was actually Marvin Gaye who brought Jack Ashford to Motown, introduced him to the group of musicians known as the Funk Brothers, and he happened to meet Jack Ashford in a jazz club in Boston.
Right.
Oh, that's great.
You know, the thing is, see, I insulted him when I first met him, because when he introduced himself to me, I didn't know him. Because, you know, when he was introduced, they said, well, this is Marvin Gaye. I said, hey, how you doing? What do you play? I thought he played a horn or something. So he said, you never heard of me? I said, no, what do you play? You know, he says, well, I got a song, I think it's Pride and Joy or Hitchhike or something.
Right.
And he was amazed that I'd never heard of it. Plus, he had on a green suit. So I'd never seen anybody wear a pea green suit.
So, Marvin Gaye, breaking the boundaries again. Jack Ashford, last question for you. When the album came out and it was floating around Motown before it got very public, was there a sense in the studio that something new had happened here? Or was this just another album out off the factory?
No. That wasn't the atmosphere of Motown, period. Because after it left our hands, those questions that you're asking and that atmosphere mm-hmm. existed on an echelon level, you know. Next thing we knew, it was out. You know, we
on to the next project.
Oh, yeah. Because we turned out, remember, for 14 years, every session turned out a platinum or gold record. So it was kind of routine after we got finished. Our thing was, well, who's next?
And Jack Ashford, do you brag about being part of this album today, or is it just one of many for you?
No, I don't brag about it. Well, I don't brag about anything I ever did at Motown because it was an experience that only happens once. And I thank God for me having the opportunity to be at Motown at the right time and everything, a historical moment. I'm very thankful to God for that, but only to God. Because I could have missed it, you know what I'm saying?
And you didn't, and I think you've got some bragging rights, whether you use them or not. Jack Ashford, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Jack Ashford was a percussionist who worked with Marvin Gaye on many projects, including his album, What's Going On? Right on from Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. Ben Edmonds, talk to us, if you can, about the influences that went into this and how it changed music, if it did, on the other side. In some ways, this album, as unlike earlier Motown as it was, marked the end of Motown's heyday. What was going on in influences before and after?
Well, before you had the kind of hippie rock revolution that we touched on previously that turned the record industry from a singles industry into an album industry, you also had the kind of social input into popular music that you had not had before. You had a lot of experimentation with the music itself. And these things had all happened in the greater musical world years before they got to Motown. You know, the fact that Marvin didn't break through with What's Going On until 1971 shows you how far behind the times Motown was to a certain extent, because all of these innovations are 60s innovations that didn't arrive at Motown until 1971. So Motown was kind of this walled kingdom, and Berry Gordy wanted to keep all of his people on one side of the wall and not have them terribly connected to what was going on in the streets on the other side of that wall.
Janet Jackson has called Marvin Gaye our John Lennon, and I guess by that she means Black America's John Lennon. Do you think it's an apt parallel?
I think it is to a certain extent, although with Marvin Gaye, I mean, Marvin had so many accomplishments in so many different areas of music that when you look at his career in overview, you see that What's Going On is just one moment of brilliance in a stylistic range that, oh God, has to have been at least two or three bandwidths wider than John Lennon's.
Oh, so you're calling a bigger river than old John Lennon.
To a certain extent, although it's something that is very different because John Lennon was kind of the artist he was from day one. Marvin Gaye had to fight to become that kind of artist within the Motown system.
He was working on that persona, and I don't know how much was deliberate and how much was a result of his depression and state of mind, but as he made and came out with What's Going On, he had a whole different look, a whole new appearance to the world. Even the jacket cover of the album was something new in the theatric side.
Exactly, and for starters, the album was in color on both sides, which for Motown was highly unusual. Marvin also listed the individual musicians on the album, which was the first time that the musicians were actually credited on a Motown album for all the years of brilliance that they had put in.
Okay.
Berry Gordy had never permitted them to be credited.
So this was the first time you could turn it over and read who had played what?
Exactly. It was also the first gatefold album on a Motown album, the first to have lyrics. Now, once again, all of these are things that rock and roll fans will know as kind of 60s innovations. But once again, Motown was such a closed shop that until Marvin Gaye broke down these barriers, it wasn't until 1971.
We're listening to Inner City Blues behind us here. Talk to us about Marvin Gaye himself, Jack Ashford, said when he first met him, he had on a pea green suit. He underwent a kind of transformation around the time of this album as well.
Indeed, he did. Like John Lennon, like Jim Morrison, like a lot of quote-unquote pop stars who were no longer happy with the kind of superficial nature of their fame, Marvin tried to distance himself from the very slick, besuited image that was kind of the traditional Motown performer's image. He grew a beard. He started to wear Levi's. He refused to wear suits, except for the photo session of this album cover. I mean, once again, Marvin could even be contentious with himself. You know, I mean, he would reverse his own thoughts from one moment to the next. So, but no, basically, Marvin took the entire Motown machinery with this album and turned it inside out.
Inner City Blues, and it's got that title in parentheses, makes me want to holler. Marvin Gaye here is talking about send that boy off to die, makes me want to holler. The way they do my life, make me want to holler. How was Marvin Gaye received with this album in the black community?
Well, pretty much as it was received the world around. The thing was not so much how it was received in the black community, because there were other people happening at the time, whether it be Sly Stone, whether it be Jimi Hendrix. There were other black performers who were breaking down these barriers. But once again, it was the fact that Marvin Gaye had done this within the closed shop of Motown, and in so doing, he opened up whole new vistas for Motown artists, especially Stevie Wonder, has always credited Marvin Gaye and what's going on with expanding his creative vision. He would not have been able to come up with works like Talking Book and Inner Vision were it not for the precedent of what's going on.
What did Marvin ever say on the record about the album?
Marvin said that it was a gift from God to him, and a gift from God to the people through him. And I think both of those things are absolutely accurate and sum the album up, because if you listen to the rest of his recorded output, there is nothing else that he ever did that sounds even remotely like this.
Marvin Gaye's One of a Kind. We're talking about Marvin Gaye's legendary album, What's Going On Tonight. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. What do you hear when you hear What's Going On? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Marvin Gaye's album, What's Going On? Here's a 2001 All-Star tribute to the title cut.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying.
Five.
last year's trade or a benefit, AIDS benefit album, a cover of What's Going On by Marvin Gaye with a big lineup, Backstreet Boys, Bono, Lil Kim, Jennifer Lopez, Britney Spears, all kinds of the big pop stars of right now. And you heard just a little bit there of Nora Gaye, Marvin Gaye's daughter, singing Father, Father. The father's long gone, but the album lives on and lives on strong. It's being covered all over the place. We're talking tonight with Ben Edmonds. He's American editor of Mojo Magazine and author of What's Going On, Marvin Gaye and the Last Days of the Motown Sound. And we're joined now by Ty Moses, a writer and managing editor for Alternet.org. Wrote the article, The Rebirth of Marvin Gaye. Good evening and welcome, Ty Moses.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, great. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Listen, I loved your article. Talk to us about why this music is such a magnet for current pop artists to cover and to make their own mixes of.
Well, one of the things I think that makes What's Going On so enduring is that it's so universal still. The songs speak to everyone, no matter what their politics are and no matter what color your skin is or what language you speak. The music doesn't seem to belong to any one group more than another, and I think Marvin just kind of brings out the soul in everyone, and that's why everyone wants to be part of it.
What do you think is that core message, the core magnetism that it has for other singers, that it has for listeners in America and around the world? How would you describe it, define it?
It's hard to define, but I can only tell you what it does for me or what I think, and that is there. It doesn't seem that there's a barrier between the listener and the music. There's such candor and purity in the songs and the lyrics and the way Marvin sings them on What's Going On that it punctures your emotional defenses. And he meant what he was singing, and you can tell. Anyone who listens to it can tell. The music doesn't lie.
That's so unlike what we think of as the heavily staged, managed Motown sound in so many circumstances. Was it because he'd been knocked down, had hard times, he was depressed and couldn't do anything but tell it like it was?
Exactly. I think that's true. And I think that Ben Edmonds has written about this much more extensively than I have, that Marvin was depressed and he said that he made his best music when he was depressed.
In a tough world, maybe that kept him going. Maybe that informed a whole sound. What songs hold up the best for you on this album, Ty Moses?
Well, I love the title track, and I also love Mercy, Mercy Me. I'd have to say those are my favorites.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see that tenderness that's in here growing up out of Marvin Gaye's life and personality? There's a tenderness both at a kind of emotional level, and he also, there's so many allusions to physical tenderness, to sexual tenderness throughout this album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. The 60s were over, of course, when it came out, but the emotion and the pain and the confusion that he expresses are very much a product of the 60s. And, I mean, I was just a kid during that time, but I think no matter what age you were, you pick up on that confusion of that decade and the images that are conjured up when you listen to this album, the Vietnam War, protesters, civil rights demonstrations, and the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. And Bobby Kennedy. All of it is so emotional, and Marvin managed to express all of that.
I'm always so struck at the way he managed to make pain and war and suffering so listenable. And it makes me wonder about this kind of this sad sweetness, the way, it, in a way, it was even a deeper kind of acknowledgement, not just that there were bad things going on, they were being acknowledged in every lyric in this album, but he was expressing at the same time, it always seemed to me, a determination or an underlying joy that was going to be there, even if it was surrounded by sadness.
It's true. That's such a good way of putting it. He personalized it so much. And you always hear that people are hungry for answers, but I think people are hungrier for questions, to have someone they can trust asking the right questions. And that's exactly what Marvin Gaye did on this album.
In a big way. Ben Edmonds, is it depression or joy or some battle in Marvin Gaye's heart and soul that we hear here?
We're hearing all of the above and then more, because what we're hearing ultimately, I think, is we are hearing the spirit moving through a human being to touch other human beings, and that in itself is certainly a miracle.
It's a It's a great anti-war anthem, of course, what's going on. Do you think it speaks to the kind of conflicts we see today, Ben?
I think it does, because the basic situations that create those conflicts are still there, which is that we don't communicate with one another. And that is the basic message of what's going on, that only through love and only through communication can these kind of wounds be healed. And you sort of ask what the continuing relevance of this album is, and it's definitely the fact that you can tangibly hear the spirit made flesh on this record. From my point of view, the way that they used to put Bibles in hotel rooms, mm-hmm. they should probably put a copy of this album in every hotel room and in every home in America and the world, because we still need the kind of communication and love that Marvin Gaye was talking about now more than ever.
Ty Moses, what about it? Do you want to see what's going on tucked into every hotel room in America next to the Gideon's Bible?
Oh, I love that idea. I'm ready to help you do it, Ben.
That would be great. We're listening here to a live version of what's going on, recorded at the Kennedy Center Auditorium in Washington, D.C. on May 1st, 1972. Of course, Marvin Gaye's life was cut short. He died in 1984, and the gun was fired by his own father, Ben Edmonds.
Yes, it was. And there had been a long history of jealousy, and some people will tell you even hatred on the part of the father toward the son, which is in itself a tragedy. But the enduring aspect of all of this is that with this album, though Marvin Gaye's father was a preacher, with what's going on, Marvin Gaye preached a much greater sermon than anything his father ever accomplished.
Ben Edmonds, author of What's Going On, Marvin Gaye and the Last Days of Motown Sound, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Ty Moses, a writer and managing editor with Alternet.org, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can listen to clips from Marvin Gaye's album What's Going On. Just go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. But first, let's listen to the sounds of the past week.
We call for immediate, meaningful ceasefire and an immediate Israeli withdrawal.
We gather in this great abbey to mourn and to give thanks. It's a fitting place to do so. A place where the story of our nation and the story of the woman we now commend to her heavenly father are intertwined.
The day started with the massive street demonstrations many in Venezuela have become accustomed to. Tens of thousands of opponents to President Hugo Chavez gathered at the headquarters of the state oil company.
I don't believe I was tried by a jury of my peers.
Okay.
I think peers have an understanding of a person's character. I think there are very few people on this jury that really knew Jim Trafficant.
I know that there are many who believe my resignation is part of the solution. It distresses me greatly to have become a lightning rod of division when mine should be a ministry of unity.
The Prime Minister and I had good discussions on the nature of the operations that are underway. He understands President Bush's position. We had a chance to exchange those positions.
So I saw the bus, you know, then we saw some, you know, somebody, some people with no arms, with no heads, blood all over, you know.
Again, the president's very troubled by this. And today would be a very good day for Yasser Arafat to explain to the world what he said when he committed himself to Oslo, that he denounces these very types of attacks.
There was Kofi Annan on the conflict in Israel, the Queen Mother being memorialized in England, turmoil in Venezuela, Jim Trafficant, congressman, found guilty of corruption charges, a news anchor reading from Cardinal Bernard Law's letter saying he will not step down from his position, and then a lot of sound from the Middle East. Jack Beatty, this is a week when Catholics and everybody else could use some moral guidance and that voice of authority, and the same week Cardinal Law is besieged.
Yeah, the Cardinal. I was just looking up some accounts of the of the Protestant Reformation. It's interesting when young Martin Luther, who was a monk, went to Rome in 1515 or so thereabouts. He was shocked by what he saw, the decadence. The word he used was sodomy. And writing about that period later on, Ronca, the historian, said, even depravity may have its perfection. When you think of this.
Oh, jeez. It's not the perfection we want to associate with the Holy See.
No, and yet our diocese seems to have had a perfection of depravity in these cases. And, you know, you just wonder that something big could be beginning here. The people taking the church back from this corrupt and really now besieged hierarchy.
But Boston's cardinal seems to be saying this week they may do it, but he's not going to step out of the way for them to do it.
No, they may just do it on their own.
And then, Jack, we hear so much all week long. I've heard tonight, I've heard in these clips, the sounds from the Middle East, just from bad to worse and worse and worse.
It really is. I was just watching CNN, and it's just hard even to watch. And there was a piece in yesterday's Times balancing it on the horrors in one of these cities that the Israeli army had hit, and talking about tanks, bulldozers knocking buildings down on people. A picture really of the whole infrastructure of the West Bank being ripped up. Pylons, power plants, roads, sewers, waterworks, almost as if there's some method to this, and the method might well be make it uninhabitable and essentially complete Sharon's old vision that Jordan would become the Palestinian state.
And the answer comes from the Palestinians today in a suicide bombing in Jerusalem that, interestingly, Ari Fleischer, the president's press secretary, today called not a suicide bombing, but a homicide bombing.
Yeah, apparently that's how the Israelis refer to it as well. And that was part of the sort of distancing that was going on in the White House from Colin Powell's own mission. On the one hand, they were backing him, and on the other hand, they were saying, well, if he meets Arafat, that's up to him. And President Bush apparently said that again today. It's almost as if poor Colin Powell is being set up for a fall here. And he's, of course, got deep enemies in the administration. And a lot of them angry about 1991 and about the way that under his pressure, the first President Bush decided not to finish the war against Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And interestingly, Sharon, in his meeting today with Arafat, is reported to have,
with Powell,
is reported to have brought that up and said, you know, in 1991, you guys didn't go after...
Put it right in Secretary Powell's face.
Yeah.
But George Bush, this President George Bush, may take his own pain from this conflict as well, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, he's come down some in the polls. He's clearly, I mean, he just sent a vice president to capitals in the Middle East and asking about help with Iraq. They all said no. He's now sent a Secretary of State to Arab capitals, asking them to come out against terror bombing now. They wouldn't do it. And then asking the Israeli Prime Minister to stop the assault on the West Bank. He wouldn't do it. This has been a bad week, bad month, really, for American diplomacy. And yet, at the same time, it's been a good one, because for the first time, the president seems to have understood the dimensions of this crisis. Maybe too late.
And they are enormously large. Jack, have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
And you too, and thank you.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Tim Munro, and Laura Tenguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.